What is social anthropology? Let me start by giving a few definitions. The Oxford English Dictionary defines anthropology as the science of man or of mankind in the widest sense. This was the way in which the word was used roughly between about 1550 and 1850, though since then it's had a much more varied history and there are many specific meanings. It is a very wide definition, and this wideness has continued in relation to the social sciences in general and anthropology. C. Wright Mills writes that what social science is properly about is the human variety, which consists of all the social worlds in which men have lived, are living, and might live. In one sense, anthropology, the study of man, encompasses psychology, philosophy, history, sociology, and all the other disciplines as well. And indeed, some of the great practitioners, E.B. Tyler, Boas, Malinowski, Evans Pritchard, Levi-Strauss, Clifford Geertz, have made contributions to all these different disciplines and drawn on them as well. Anthropology is a way of looking at the world rather than a discipline in the usual sense. This is partly caught by Levi-Strauss when he said that there were three true vocations, vocation meaning a calling, as in a religious vocation: music, mathematics, and anthropology. You study history or you study economics, you are an anthropologist. Anthropology for many provides the same functions as philosophy in helping to make of the world and seeing why it happens. The structure of anthropology is a total one. One of the central features of anthropological research is the desire to study the interconnections or interrelatedness of life in societies. It's what's called a holistic discipline. That is a study of the parts in relation to the whole. Holistic is spelled without a W, by the way. As Malinowski put it, an anthropologist who sets out to study only religion, or only technology, or only social organization, cuts out an artificial field for inquiry. He further says that one of the first conditions of acceptable work certainly is that it should deal with the totality of all social, cultural, and psychological aspects of the community, for they are so interwoven that not one can be understood without taking into consideration all the others. This attempt to study the totality arose out of several of the earlier discoveries of the discipline. One was that only by setting religious myths or symbolic acts such as sacrifice or witchcraft beliefs in their whole background could you really make sense of them. Otherwise, if they are taken out of their context, they seem bizarre, irrational, even childish and fantastical. If beliefs are jerked out of their context, they become crazy, and that would happen just as much to our own beliefs as anyone else's. This was particularly the case because in many parts of the societies where anthropologists worked, the sharp differentiation that we tend to make in our own society between different spheres of life are not made. One central feature of our modern world is that we try and pretend that religion, kinship, economics, and politics are separable, whereas of course they all influence each other deeply. But in most societies, no such pretense is made. Every action, every thought has various levels to it. For example, a small gift not only has an economic function, but also a ritual, kinship, social, and other dimensions. This is one of the reasons why we find that many of the famous anthropologists, like Evans Pritchard, Robert Lowy, or Raymond Firth, have written books on kinship, books on economics, books on religion, and on politics. because all these things are interlinked in the societies where they worked. Another aspect of anthropology is the way in which it mixes together a study of society and of culture. In Britain, the discipline is called social anthropology. In America, it is usually called cultural anthropology. And although there are some differences of emphasis in those two backgrounds, they deal basically with the same things. Put very simply, the difference between society and culture can be seen by looking at this Chinese hat that I bought in Shan in central China, in a Muslim part of the old city. The social structure, that is the shape of the hat, if you see, it's got a rather interesting kind of triangular shape here. This reflects traditional Islamic design. On the other hand, the surface, the brilliant red colour, the encrusted fake jewels, is Chinese. So it combines beautifully in one object two civilizations. Put in another way, when examining a wedding, if we ask the question, who did the bride marry? Was it a cousin or other relative? Then we are asking about social structure. If we ask what she wore and what religious and other rituals occurred, then we are asking more about culture. They are analytically separable, yet obviously closely related. So anthropologists want to know not only what people do, but how they perceive their world and what significance their actions have. A nice example is given by the anthropologist Clifford Geertz. An eye may shut for a moment during an event. For instance, my eyes may go like that while I'm talking to you. But there is a world of difference depending on whether it was a voluntary action, a wink, or an involuntary one, a blink. The anthropologist needs to know which it is. Many argue that it is the manipulation of symbols in speech and thought that above all distinguishes human beings from other animals. So a great deal of anthropology is concerned with trying to understand other systems of thought and feeling and the way they manipulate symbols. As Malinowski again put it, the aim is to grasp the native's point of view, his relation to life, to realize his vision of his world, not ours. Now, for modern readers, one would put in, of course, hers as well as his, and also wouldn't perhaps talk about natives, but the other's vision of their world, rather than our attempt to infiltrate it. The aim is to penetrate into the world view of another society, or a part of our own, which we do not really know about, or we know about but don't really understand. Having studied this, we may try to return and somehow make that different world view comprehensible to people around us, including ourselves. So we have to abandon our narrow vision, that based on our own ethnos or way of life, which usually makes us so ethnocentric. We have to take an imaginative leap out of our own assumptions and to consider other possible worlds within which human beings still live. To understand a people's thought, one has to think in their symbols, as Evans Pritchard put it. The jolt to our own unexamined assumptions may be painful, but it helps us, in the words of Margaret Mead, to escape from the bondage of asking only the questions that are based on our own and other known civilizations. We learn new things. Or as an anthropologically minded historian John Elliott writes, seriously to study another way of life is necessarily to extend our own, not simply to bring the other way within the already existing boundaries of our own. One of the central features of anthropology is that it's a broadly comparative discipline. All knowledge is comparative. Human beings are comparators, that is, constantly understanding things by comparing them to something else. Thus we only know white by comparing it to black, male to female, and so on. Anthropology is the great comparative discipline. It's always comparing, sometimes explicitly, sometimes implicitly, different worlds. It tries to locate parts of the comparison outside our own familiar culture, which then throws our own world into a new perspective. We become freed from insularity, hopefully, and suddenly see things in a new light. One method is really distinctive of anthropology. Anthropologists use historical materials, archaeological materials, many kinds of materials. But one of the peculiarities of anthropology is that, unlike almost any other discipline I know of, much of the material is generated by the anthropologist or observer themselves. In the 1890s, A.C. Haddon of Cambridge, as well as Franz Boas in America, began to lay the foundations for one of anthropology's unique contributions to human thought, namely the method of collecting data known as the participant observation fieldwork method. A person goes for a year or more to become soaked in an alien culture. As one person put it, they become like a musical instrument upon which the culture plays. But they not only live and participate in that society, but they observe the musician playing on them, so to speak. And they learn the language, both the spoken language and the language of gestures, postures, expectations and behaviours. They record and study the effect of the culture on themselves, and whatever they notice and feel is useful. This intensive soaking in the world of other peoples has enormously expanded the insular views of the societies from which anthropologists came. It has, over the last century and a half, helped to preserve some records of ways of life which have more or less vanished in the onrush of global industrial capitalism. The fieldwork is a method of collecting material, but it is only worthwhile or even possible if the observer has some ideas of their own. We see the world through a frame, only in answer to certain questions, and these questions should be made quite explicit and constantly rehearsed. What anthropologists tend to do is to take some very general hypotheses about human nature and then go and test them. Is the Oedipus complex universal? Is romantic love universal? How do different family systems work? How does violence, is violence a basic characteristic of human beings, and so on. So we try and see a world in a grain of sand to study the general in the very particular and then come back with some answers. So what kind of societies do anthropologists study, or groups of people? Throughout its history of roughly 150 years fieldwork anthropology, it's been particularly concerned with other societies. These were often located within the empires of European powers, or what more recently was called the Third World. They were often small scale, whether bushman bands in Australia or Africa, or tribal groups in South America, Southeast Asia, or the Middle East, or peasant villages and communities in the great civilizations of China, India, the Mediterranean, or South America. But from the middle of the 20th century, there's been a growing interest in applying the approach and the methods and the philosophy to societies which couldn't, by any stretch of the imagination, be called faraway, small-scale, non-industrial, non-Western societies. As the American anthropologist Kroeber wrote in the 1950s, the anthropology of the future will not be concerned above all with primitives, and he was right. For instance, during the last 30 years that I've been teaching in Cambridge, at least half of the PhD theses in social anthropology have been about subjects in industrial societies and nations or in Western cultures. Studies of housing estates, unemployment offices, the United Nations, tourist destinations, the internet, and many other such topics. So why study anthropology? Keith Thomas, a historian deeply influenced by anthropology, has written that the justification of all historical study must ultimately be that it enhances our self-consciousness, enables us to see ourselves in perspective, and helps us towards that greater freedom which comes from self-knowledge. This is equally true of anthropology. Throughout the study of the marvellous intricacy and extraordinary diversity of human societies, from the supposedly simplest to the most complex, each one showing many features which are alien to us, social anthropology widens and deepens our knowledge of others and also of ourselves. It should change not only what we know, but how we perceive the world. So that when we watch the news, travel, work, play, we see things differently. It's a new pair of mental spectacles. Let me end with a personal narrative. Since this piece is to appear on my website, I'll end by briefly giving an example of an anthropologist's life from my own experience. This is not typical or representative, but it shows something of what interests us. I've worked in many parts of the world. I started by concentrating on my own society, becoming a social historian of Britain, and learning something about my European culture. I then worked in Nepal. I first did field work for 15 months and subsequently for another 2 years in over 15 further visits to a remote hill village in the foothills of the Annapurna Mountain. Later, I did anthropological and historical study of the forest-dwelling Naga peoples of the borders between northeastern India and Burma. At first this was based on historical materials because the area was closed, but at the end of the study I was able to make a trip to Nagaland itself. Alongside this, I visited Japan on 6 occasions from 1990 onwards and made a study of that enormously complex and rich history and culture over the last 1,000 years. I then visited China on 4 occasions and travelled several times from the northeastern to the southwestern parts of that vast civilization, filming and exploring its diverse cultures. Interleaved with these were half a dozen visits to other places, to Australia many times, several times to America, to India, to South Korea once and elsewhere. These are the places which I now stock my mind with as I think comparatively. And I also read about other places, South America, Africa, Russia and Eastern Europe and the Middle East, which I haven't yet had a chance to visit but hope to do so. So these are the diversity. In terms of themes on which I work, going back over my life, it's shifted and spiraled, moving off to new areas and then coming back on itself with a different understanding. I started with the history of witchcraft and magic in 17th, 16th century England. Why did people believe in witches and persecute them? This theme led a little later into a study of heresy and the Portuguese Inquisition, and some attempts to understand legal systems around the world and their consequences. I've long been interested in population problems and patterns, why populations grow or decline, and what effects this has had. And this was related to economic factors, so I made a study of population and agricultural production and technology in the Himalayas. Also, obviously influencing population are family patterns. So I studied family systems, wrote about marriage and about love, and looked at family structures around the world, historically and anthropologically. Early on, I'd done work on incest behaviour and continued to be interested in the variations in sexual behaviour and its relationship to religion and culture. I've also long been interested in violence and crime, and this led to a study of banditry and mafia-like behaviour in English history. The interest in population is not only related, obviously, to fertility, but also to mortality, to death rates. And so I became interested in disease and death, and in particular, the reasons for different disease patterns in Asia and the West over long periods. A different interest is in political philosophy, and this led to studies of political ideologies, concepts of liberty and of the origins of civil society, and the traditions of Western society when compared with other cultures and political patterns. A final theme is an interest in technologies, both using new computers, technologies and films, and also studying the history of technology, which led to a particular study of the history of glass and its impact on civilization. And this, surprisingly, led into aesthetics and art, and the problems of the origins of modern perspective. Technology has also led into the technologies of consumption and led me into a study of tea and its effects around the world and its global consequences. This is all quite a wide range of places and themes. So what doesn't interest an anthropologist? Well, looking around my library, or thinking of the questions I've asked in the 30 letters I've written to my granddaughter Lily to explain how the world works or how I think it works, I find it difficult to find any large area of human existence which doesn't interest me at all, even if, of course, I'm woefully ignorant of many, especially the hard sciences. As the social historian Marc Bloch wrote of historians, so it's true of anthropologists. He wrote that they are like the giant in the fairy story. Wherever they smell human flesh, there their quarry is. Wherever there are human societies, an anthropologist is interested. Anthropology is a marvellous license to roam around the world, to be inquisitive. I have never known any of the hundreds of proposed undergraduate thesis topics in Cambridge in the anthropology department to be disallowed because it was not anthropology, even if some were unfeasible, unethical, or unimaginative. Anthropology, the study of humankind, is a wonderful discipline, it seems to me. It's one which seems particularly relevant in this 21st century, when the world is increasingly interdependent and closely linked, yet constantly riven by cultural misunderstandings. Anthropology may give us some clues to resolving those misunderstandings. Thank you.